You're listening to a podcast from the South China Morning Post.
Hello and welcome to the US-China Trade War Podcast with me, Finbar Birmingham, from the Political Economy Desk at the South China Morning Post. It's a beautiful spring-like day in Hong Kong. The sky is blue and it looks quite warm outside, but I wouldn't know since I've been isolating and socially distancing all week and probably lacking in vitamin D. It's been another rapid week of news pertaining to the global coronavirus pandemic. We are starting to see some real material chunks being taken out of the global economy. I'll be joined on the line by John Carter and Joe Shin, the political economy editors here, all of us from our respective cubbyholes dotted around Hong Kong, to discuss the damage that is currently being done. And then I'll be delighted to be joined by David Dodwell, our columnist here at the South China Morning Post, executive director of the Hong Kong APEC Trade Policy Think Tank, who has spent decades studying global trade and supply chains. I've asked David to dust off his crystal ball and channel his inner Alvin Toffler, and we're going to find out what he thinks will be the lasting legacy of COVID-19 on our globalized economy. Stay tuned. Okay, I'm delighted to be joined by John Carter and Joe Shin, who are the editors of the Political Economy Desk at the South China Morning Post. Gentlemen, last week there was a bit of a heated scuffle online, and we called it the blame game in the newspaper. These so-called wolf warriors within China's Ministry of Foreign Affairs blaming the US Army for starting the virus. On the other hand, Mike Pompeo, the Secretary of State, and Donald Trump were constantly and variously referring to it as the China virus or the Wuhan virus. And really, it was very unseemly. This week, it has developed somewhat, and we've seen some of the steam come out of it with the Chinese ambassador to America seemingly taking a bit of the heat off, and things seem to have had a more conciliatory tone in an interview he did with the Axios publication. Joshin, are we starting to see an internal power struggle, or have we seen that within the China's Ministry of Foreign Affairs over the past couple of weeks in relation to the approach to the United States and to the messaging on the coronavirus?
Yes, thank you, Finbar. I think after last week's kind of war of wars, especially on the Chinese side, I think they realized it's a little bit going too far. So that's why even you can see from Zhao Lijian himself, he has been toning down his rhetoric as well. And from all these different channels, you know, from all the way up from Zhao Lijian to Cui Tiankai to even Xi Jinping himself, you know, the tone has changed. Basically, it's saying China is sending the message saying, you know, this coronavirus is a challenge for all human beings. So it's a common challenge. And let's stop this blame game, trying to find out who is really who should be blamed or whose fault it is. Rather, the focus should be moving forward. And that's why, you know, given consideration of the G20 special summit is going to be held in a couple of hours, and China's message is about cooperation, coordination, and also unity. Mm-hmm. Well, I think that's quite reasonable for China to propose such a position, given the fact that China has largely brought the coronavirus, the outbreak and control within China, although the situation in other parts of the world are getting really serious. So China is trying to play a role, a kind of, you know, the reasonable man in the room. You know, at the very beginning, China was widely blamed for the cover-up, for, you know, for lecturing the doctor Li Wenliang, for not alerting WHO, for not allowing US experts into China. And now China is trying to turn the table, saying, yes, we may have made some mistakes at the beginning, but that doesn't matter anymore because moving forward, you need my masks, you need my experiences, and I'm willing to offer the help. And I think that's the Beijing's position now. And that's also what Xi Jinping will walk into the, not walk into the room, when he turned on this video conference this evening. I think that's a message going to be from Beijing for the rest of the world.
Yes. And John Carter, from President Donald Trump, we have seen a toning down of the rhetoric. You mentioned earlier, Pompeo seems to not have gotten the memo. with his refusal to sign a statement from the G7 if it wasn't referred to as the Wuhan coronavirus. But just in terms of the relative wider cooling, do you see that as fear over escalating what is a dangerous situation at a time when the global economy needs cooperative and multilateral working together?
Absolutely. I think that it's suddenly dawning on people that this is a real global crisis on the order of the Second World War, perhaps, where everybody has to choose a side. And in this case, the side is humanity, to save as many people as possible and to repair the global economy as quickly as possible. And that will take everybody working together. And that is suddenly dawning on people, many of whom have just been reflexively going about their, what you might call their Cold War mentality. But now what is required in order to solve the problem is cooperation.
Indeed. And the problem itself obviously was revealed in greater detail this week. We saw some horrible numbers from China last week. This week, it's been the turn of Europe and America. We've seen some forecasts for the U.S. economy to drop as much as 50% in the second quarter of the year, which is absolutely mind-blowing. We've seen PMI numbers, the Purchasing Manager Index, come out of Europe, which shows far deeper recession predicted than even during the global financial crisis, which threatened to derail the European Union and the Eurozone in general. John, there are bazookas going off all over the place. The Fed has gone all in, the biggest intervention in history. The US government is passing a $2 trillion support bill, and yet China is seemingly keeping its powder dry.
That's right. And this is a matter of debate. On the one hand, you have the question of whether the Chinese government is doing enough. And I would note that the prominent investment bank, CICC, slashed their economic forecast for China for this year from 6.1% before to 2.6%, and said that what the Chinese government has done to support the economy is, quote unquote, insufficient. Now, in the Chinese government's defense, they came to the world economy's rescue back in 2008, passing a massive economic stimulus program. But the unintended consequences of that, the side effects of that, are still with them today. Massive debt, excess capacity, infrastructure projects that have very little usefulness. I mean, everyone has heard about the cities that they've built with very few people living in them. And so they're very wary about going all in as they did back in 2008, and understandably so. What we're likely to see, and I want to emphasize the Chinese government has not done nothing. They've done quite a bit, and there's likely to do more in the days and weeks ahead. But it may not come to resemble what they did back in 2008 or what the U.S. is doing now.
One thing I would like to highlight is the economic decision makers. We all know that, you know, Xi Jinping came into power with this Xiconomics, which is about deleveraging, cut excessive capacity. And his top economic aide, Liu He, has famously written articles that saying, you know, basically what lessons we can learn from the global financial crisis. And I think one of the biggest takeaway by China from the global financial crisis from then is like, China should not go into the same river for twice. I mean, do not get into the big stimulus again. And basically that's the mindset behind China's economic policy making these days. So it's very difficult, or I must say the threshold is very, very high for China to announce a new round of stimulus.
Is there a dynamic there, Jiuxin, that people maybe don't see outside of China, a sort of a debate going on in any sort of public arena?
Well, I can see that, you know, there is still debate within Beijing about whether China should be more aggressive in terms of stimulus and monetary easing. And for now, I think those winning the debate is leaning towards of having a more measured or moderate response instead of an out stimulus or monetary easing. That said, you know, the Central Bank of China, the People's Bank of China, is still under huge pressure of cutting the 1 year deposit rate, which will help the banking system a lot. Because when you're telling banks to lend cheap money to the borrowers on one hand, on the other hand, you have to lower the cost for the banks a little bit. Otherwise, the banking system cannot be sustained.
Another element, Finbar, is in the G7 tonight. If there's a movement towards coordinated and cooperation in terms of economic policy, then maybe China will move more towards doing something more than they have already. We'll have to wait and see.
Yeah. What would that something more look like? Would it be fiscal? Everyone around the world is looking for fiscal stimulus at the moment. What could China do on that front, John?
Well, I mean, they could do anything from increasing subsidies for auto purchases, appliance purchases. There is even an idea floated by a member of the National People's Congress that you give money directly to people just as this U.S. Stimulus bill that it's working its way through Congress would do. That bill would give $1,200 to virtually every American. And you could do the same thing in China, although it would be very expensive. And please understand that they have to look at their debt level, which is very large by world standards, and when they consider these things, because it would require them to go even further into debt. But then the U.S. is throwing around trillions of dollars like it was monopoly money. So, you know, anything is possible.
Yeah. I think one thing I've found interesting in the past week or two is there are economists that I would have spoken to previously that were all very worried about national sovereign debt and stuff. There seems to be a shift towards that attitude doesn't seem so cool anymore. These people are all now calling for governments to throw everything they can, kitchen sink and all, whatever they can at their respective economies. And Joshin, do you have that same sort of popular support for stronger fiscal measures within China that you have in the United States and Europe?
Oh, of course, yes. Because, you know, it's extraordinary times, so calling for extraordinary responses. And the Chinese government has already been doing so, you know, allowing the local governments to sell more bonds. And also some companies have already applied to sell coronavirus bonds. Specifically, this bonds is you know, for you to manage the impacts from the coronavirus. So it's very interesting. Yeah. And also there are, on the streets, you know, people, as John said, people are asking the same question. You know, everywhere around the world, we're seeing Hong Kong, we're seeing the United States, and the government is giving money, handing out money, cash to the people. You know, why not? Why the Chinese government can't do that? And the Chinese government has a huge fiscal revenue. 19 trillion yuan revenue last year, you know, so lots of money, lots of revenues for the government. Yeah. So there are kind of moods like the government should do more to help the people. You know, the small businesses in China are suffering. Today I read one report, maybe not very reliable, but they say in the first 2 months already over 10,000 companies in the tourism industry have filed for bankruptcy. It's a mind-boggling number, I mean. So there, naturally, yes, there are more hopes and more expectations on the government to do more, even though you know, the fiscal deficit will be enlarged a little bit. So what's the problem? I mean, the economy is contracting, and it's a moment for the government to step in. So there are less and less controversy about this increased spending.
It seems to be an extraordinary situation where we have the capitalist world looking to China to become slightly more socialist in their economic policy. And John, what we may see in the next week or two and coming months is even more pressure as we see China's economy take a second wave of damage from the lag in demand in the West and also domestically.
Yes, I mean, this is, there's a number of second waves going on. The second waves of the virus itself and the second economic wave. Just as China's getting its supply, getting its factories running, then there's a question of, is there going to be any demand from the United States or from Europe for the things that they produce? And so that's going to hit Chinese exports, and it's going to filter down an still fragile supply chain and make life difficult for the Chinese. And then domestically, because many workers lost income in January and February, they don't have purchasing power. Many are still laid off or furloughed. Many have lost their jobs entirely. And so the idea that consumer spending can bounce back strongly it seems unlikely to me. So you're going to have an issue with domestic demand. as you point out. And as Joshin points out, there's a large number of small businesses in particular who are running out of cash. They have nobody coming in to do business, and yet they still have to pay rent and they have to pay worker salary, and they're running out of money. And eventually they will fold. And that is also going to hurt. Continue to hurt the Chinese economy. I'm not saying there's a collapse coming in the Chinese economy, but they're not out of the woods yet.
Absolutely not. Well, look, John, Joshin, that has been most interesting as ever, and we've had it peppered with some live traffic sounds from your respective apartments dotted around Hong Kong, because again, we're having to do all this remotely at the moment. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Finbar.
Thank you, Finbar.
Delighted to be joined by David Dodwell, who is a longtime columnist at the South China Morning Post, and of course, a veteran watcher of global trade and supply chains. David, great to have you on this call. Great to see you on this Zoom call. One of your columns this week was about perhaps the permanent changes we may see to what has become a very globalized world economy as a result of the coronavirus pandemic. And now, while I wouldn't suggest that you think it's all going to collapse, that wasn't the sense that I got from your piece. I do get the feeling that you think there will be real material changes. Give us a highlight or two from that piece as to what you think this will do to the globalized economy.
Well, in part, I was focusing on the increasingly widespread gossip about decoupling and the likelihood that the US and Chinese trading universes are going to be separated by a whole bunch of issues. I am basically do not accept that the world is going to decouple. I think that the interconnectivity is now far too strong for that to be manageable without some pretty catastrophic consequences. But at the same time, I think the nature of globalization and the characteristics of supply chains are likely to be in the process of long-term change because of what's been going on. Other factors contributing, but for example, the pandemic has illustrated how perhaps unacceptably fragile and vulnerable global supply chains are. That will inevitably result in, I think, quite a widespread and systemic effort to regionalize, to shorten supply chains. I think a number of economies, where possible, will domesticate parts of the supply chain. That would be interpreted by some as a decoupling. I don't believe a Microsoft is still going to want to be, or a GM is still going to want to be in China, but I think the to-ing and fro-ing along the supply chain that currently underpins both their businesses in the US and in China are likely to be restructured so that they are not as profoundly interconnected. So that kind of decoupling, if you want to call it that, will, I think, occur.
It's interesting, David, because decoupling obviously has been a real hot topic over the past couple of years, and that was mainly driven by, you know, the protectionist rhetoric and actions of the Trump administration. Of course, there was a level of, I suppose, diversification going on with the rising cost of manufacturing in China and so on before that. But it's quite ironic that it's taken something completely, you know, out of mankind's control, almost an act of God, to lead to people to actually really consider the nth degree a reconfiguration of the global supply chain.
Correct. And there's a paradox there too, in that most of the experts I'm reading and paying attention to say that this particular pandemic illustrates absolutely the need for a globalized economy and an interconnected multilateral cooperative approach to solving a problem. So in certain respects, the pandemic in its own right is an advocate for multilateralization. It's an advocate for global cooperation on issues that challenge us jointly. And so while it is providing this sort of decoupling, destabilization at a supply chain level, the broader message, probably unwelcome to those in the US that have been advocating a decoupling of the US from the Chinese economy. The bigger picture message is that multilateralism and globalization are actually forces for good rather than harm.
Yeah. We talked a bit about some of the perhaps more positive legacies that would come out of this in regard to changes in how people do things. I know actually a couple of weeks ago you had a very thought-provoking column about the change to the air traffic industry, the air travel. You know, executives may consider whether they really need to be in New York or London for a meeting when they can hop on a video call. We're obviously doing this podcast via this tool Zoom, which has sprung up, maybe I've been living in the dark ages, but out of nowhere, to my mind, to being completely omnipotent. I hadn't used it before last week. But these sorts of industries may, David, be some of those that actually have some sort of benefit come out of this.
And I think that that's a clear change that will occur. I think large numbers of companies are going to adopt video conferencing technologies that enable them to reduce business travel and to learn these technologies on a fairly systemic basis.
And this is coming at a time when technology is developing exponentially. You and I have talked in the past about the tech rivalry. Where does this potential, even a pivot towards even more reliance on technology to get business done, figure in with the current sort of tech standoff in the global among global superpowers?
So this is an interesting aspect of the challenge that we're facing. We have this imminent rollout of 5G technologies in the Huawei facilitated technology world. And those countries not adopting the Huawei technologies, although the technologies that are being rolled out in China on that scale are still 4 or 5 years perhaps behind what's going on. But we are, because of the facilitation, the strengthening of the telecoms infrastructure that will occur once 5G systems are properly in place, will enable people to use these video technologies much more widespreadly. We've seen this evidence of this already with the delivery of e-health services that occurred not only domestically within China, enabling patients who feared they were sick to find out, get advice from doctors remotely. But we're also seeing Chinese people in Europe, for example, contacting doctors, giving advice in Chinese on appropriate treatment. When they're not comfortable with or not knowledgeable about the domestic medical systems in the countries that they're currently stuck in. So I think the proliferation of things like e-health services, e-education services, clearly, as schools are being disrupted badly, are also likely to see a quantum jump in tradability, if you like, because with the new technologies facilitating that.
Yeah, and one thing that's actually come to my mind over the past few weeks is this is the first time I think that we maybe as a general public have seen the real value of 3D printing as well. You look at the manufacturing of medical devices, people printing ventilators in the United States and in Europe. You know, for me, it's always seemed almost like a sort of quirky, ethereal technology that doesn't really have penetration in mainstream society. Maybe this would be a sort of Rubicon moment for that sort of technology and how it interacts with the world of trade.
Yes, I think this is yet another example of how the catalyst here is going to trigger a number of quite fascinating changes. I think a lot of people, even weeks ago, believed that there was a possibility this pandemic would be a V-shaped problem, that it would hit as hard but quickly be resolved. It's now pretty clear that this is not going to be resolved quickly, that it's likely to be at least a year long, perhaps longer, and at least a year to a year and a half before we get vaccines that would be suitable. If we have a problem that endures for 18 months, 2 years, then the likelihood of really systemic change occurring is very, very high. I believe if this were to have been a short, sharp shock to our different societies, then businesses would have, as they did after SARS, would have rallied back to old habits. I believe that the longer this problem persists, the more likely it is that really quite systemic changes will occur, particularly huge problems, say, for the aviation and tourism industries, mm-hmm. which are going to be crippled over a three-month period, a year's period, or a year and a half of lockdowns and so on. Travel restrictions will have absolutely fundamental impacts on the structure mm-hmm. of the global tourism business.
Yeah, I mean, at what point does the abnormal become normal? I mean, surely a year to 18 months is long enough for people to become accustomed to doing without something. You know, you sort of unlearn these things. A good example, actually, David, is the cruise industry is probably something that won't see 2022 if it goes on for a year or if it goes on for an 18-month period. I mean, that is something that will be relegated to the sands of time.
Yeah, yes, it will. I mean, I think I can imagine immensely more cataclysmic implications for the we already have, if a Cathay Pacific has had to eliminate 95% of its services and is serving only 12 cities worldwide, that is in its own right, completely destructive of their business model. It's not yeah. something that could be tolerated or lived through for a year or 18 months' time. They've got a very expensive capital equipment stuck on tarmac and hundreds and thousands of staff on standby, ready to go. The commercial consequences of something of this kind enduring for a long period of time are quite unimaginable.
It brings into sharp focus perhaps what we have focused on over the past 2 years, and it maybe makes you realize that things like tariffs, things like non-tariff barriers, as important as they seem in that moment in time, they really are quite minor in comparison to everything we've seen over the past couple of months. And the breakneck pace at which this news has developed and trying to keep up with it has been a massive challenge as a journalist. Mm. I'm sure for you as a columnist, this really does put everything else that we've covered over the years in perspective.
For sure. I mean, one of the issues I reflected on a couple of weeks ago was when I grew up in the 50s and 60s in the UK, the world that preoccupied most people like myself and my family was a very tiny world. We didn't travel far. We didn't fly anywhere. We ate with the seasons. I didn't know what yogurt was as a child, and it was an exotic discovery from Switzerland, you know, in the 60s. I don't believe we'll ever revert to that kind of very tiny world, but I think there's a middle ground which no doubt many people with acute concerns about the environment and the harm we're doing would celebrate, but a lot of people would not. The urbanization that we've seen over the recent years is also much less easily sustainable without free and unfettered trade, because people living in rural areas, as it was the norm 40 years ago, were much more self-reliant and didn't depend, as you structurally have to depend in a city, on imported purchased goods that you have no capacity to produce yourself. So the new, much more urbanized worlds that we occupy can't simply revert to what existed in the 50s and 60s. Where the middle ground will fall if this endures for a long time is uncertain.
Yeah, it's going to be really fascinating to watch it unfold. You mentioned 18 months. I hope it won't be as long as that, but I think we have to really, at this stage, expect it. But David, look, thank you so much. Fantastic to talk to you and to get you back on the podcast, and we'll talk again soon.
Good to talk. Bye for now.
Hope you enjoyed this week's podcast. Thanks again to David Dodwell for joining us on the show. David was involved in our Behind the Tariffs series of podcasts last year that we made at the South China Morning Post. This was where we got the real human stories of the US-China trade war. And at the moment, it feels a bit like a quaint moment in time, but definitely check that out if you've got some time on your hands. Please take a moment to like, share, and subscribe this podcast. You can follow us at SCMP Economy on Twitter. I'm at F Birmingham. That's B-E-R, not like the city. Thanks for listening. Wash your hands, keep your distance, and we'll see you next week.
For more podcasts from the South China Morning Post, head to scmp.com, where you can hear more about technology, trade, culture, and society.